Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Fear Tab.
Shall we crack on?
Let's.
Actually, having said that, before we do, two bits of public thanks to get around to because we haven't done one of these in forever. Laurel is a brand new Patreon subscriber.
Yay.
So thank you very much, Laurel, and welcome aboard. Patreon.com/lexitecture, hashtag always be plugging. For those of you who want to know what the fuss is about.
Hashtag Ryan's so much better at this than I am. I always go, oh, that's so awesome. How lovely. These people are so great. Oh, yeah, more people could. Oh, yeah. Well, but the people we have
are so
great.
They are so great. It's true. The other thing is that I got in contact. Somebody contacted me, a student who is heading to Memorial University in Newfoundland by the name of Luca, who just messaged out of the blue and said, hey, you know what I'm great at is transcribing things. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, good for you, because I'm terrible at it. And the internet is also terrible at it because we have a Scottish co-host, and Scottish accents are the bane of all voiced text transcription automation.
There must be other accents out there that suffer the way that the Scots do with automated text, but I can't off the top of my head think of one.
Yeah, I would think there would be.
Probably the Welsh don't get on too well, but it does sort of feel like the whole internet might be trolling us sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that the Scottish rage that has made your people so famous and fearsome is kind of just what we're all after. And so engineers have designed, they're like, how can we do this in an age where everyone's going to start relying on speech to text? And someone went, I know.
Hold on. Wait a second. I've got a plan. Speaking of which, I feel like we've got to discuss Scott's Wikipedia.
Oh, yes. Okay. So, sorry, one more thing. So, Luca, just to give proper due.
Oh, of course, Luca, the excellent Luca.
So he got in touch and said, I do this thing. Would you mind if I transcribed some of your episodes? And I was like, I don't understand the question. I felt weird. I was like, I don't want to say yes, because then I've sort of asked him to do this thing for which we cannot pay him to do. But I don't want to say no, because I do, in fact, want to say yes. So I did, in fact, say yes. And he did, like, almost immediately was like, here you go, here's the first two. I did them, I don't know, in my sleep, because I'm some sort of superhuman. And I haven't put them up anywhere yet, but I'm working on that, and the best way to kind of present those so that they can be as effective as we would like them to be. But we have transcriptions for a couple of our episodes. It's the first two so far. So thanks, huge thanks to Luca for lending his frankly mystifying talents to this little endeavor.
Luca is transcription guy.
Da, da, da.
Let's get a theme tune on the go. Luca, you're entirely awesome, and thank you so much for your time. I think that's the thing. Like, transcription is something that I've had a go at myself. I had a job once as an audio typist. And it's incredibly I find it incredibly time consuming because I suck at typing. But it's really, really wonderful to have transcriptions for all sorts of reasons. And yeah, we're incredibly grateful.
Scott's Wikipedia.
Scott's Wikipedia, man. did you have a look? Did you go and check it out?
I didn't actually go check it out because I sort of felt like I had, I mean, first of all, I do not know Scots. So I felt like me actually looking at it would be a little bit like, you know, someone is like, can you believe these forgeries of late 16th century impressionist masters. And I'd be like, yeah, because I'm dumb. So I would totally believe it.
I don't know that you've... That's actually an interesting point to make. Like, how many people who don't speak Scots would actually recognise that the vast majority of Scots Wikipedia is kind of nonsense? And my God, is it nonsense? And like, Scots is a very, very interesting language for lots and lots of reasons. And one of the reasons that we've talked about before is that it's largely been pretty suppressed in large parts of Scotland. People are told not to speak Scots, particularly in school, particularly in formal contexts. And so, as would happen with any language where that has been the case, and you know, there are many other examples of this, you find that people speak Scots but don't admit to it, or know Scots but don't speak it, or mainly speak standard English but occasionally lapse into Scots with the odd word here and there. So it becomes quite a piecemeal kind of affair, given that lots of people don't believe that Scots is a language, and lots of Scottish people don't believe that Scots is a language. And it is. It's recognised by the UN, and you know, there are dictionaries and morphologies and grammars and all that kind of thing. However, it is quite... Well, I saw this via... I actually can't remember where I saw it via, but I posted about it, and then Because Language picked it up, either from me posting it or because they saw it somewhere too.
Yeah.
And they posted something about it on Twitter. And I replied to say, I laughed at this a whole lot, but it's actually not very funny.
Right.
And it is that way where there's something fucking brilliant about a guy in America somewhere going, you know what? I don't know a thing about this language. I am going to write literally thousands of articles in this language that I do not speak, do not understand, and do not recognise how it works. I'm just going to write thousands of articles. And the original post that I saw was, they also mused about how the hell this would have been achieved.
Yeah.
Because it seems that either the articles have been directly translated word from word, word for word from English, which isn't how Scots always works. It's very similar to English in a lot of ways, but there are, you know, there's phraseology and syntax that wouldn't be the same. Or it would seem that, like, a whole lot of Google Translate has been applied.
Right.
Almost sort of randomly. And yeah, that's the sheer amount of time and effort that must have gone into that is baffling to me.
Yeah, it would be a lot.
Like, I don't speak Icelandic. If I wanted to render even a short paragraph into something even vaguely resembling Icelandic, that would be hard work for me. Like, I would need to really spend some time and put some effort in and find some good resources to help me with that. And if what I ended up with wasn't Icelandic but was sort of vaguely Icelandic shaped, I wouldn't think, you know what I'm going to do? I am going to submit that to Icelandic Wikipedia.
Well, and I don't, like, the level of effort. Like, I don't edit Wikipedia articles, even if, like, I mean, I'm often not spending enough time on Wikipedia to notice errors because I don't know that kind of time on my hands. But even when I do, I kind of go, oh, that's, you know, I'll recognize that. It's like, oh, that's a little bit off. That's not quite worded properly, or that, you know, that citation is dead and doesn't link to anywhere, or, you know, these other little things. But I won't edit it because it just takes so much time. Like, it's not just a open up the site and click the button and type in your new thing. It's like, it's a process. And so to do that, not only editing, but creating, and like you say, in a language, like, what would possess someone to actually do that is just...
Yeah, that's kind of where the interest in this lies for me. Like, I'm sort of pissed off because it's incredibly culturally insensitive, I think, is the very best you can say about this approach. And potentially damaging to the notion that Scots is a language. Yeah. Which, you know, is that's a discussion that's on the table in some quarters. But at the same time, I'm just so completely mind blown by the fact that somebody's spent all this time doing this. And, you know, you're right, I do edit articles in Wikipedia, largely for typos and, you know, just cleaning up expression for the most part. I got very, very excited the other week because I was able to actually add something to a Wikipedia article that wasn't there. Because we started watching the second series, the sort of spin-off of Penny Dreadful.
Okay.
It's called Penny Dreadful City of Angels. And it features a Mexican sort of deity, saint, within the story that I'd never heard of before. And I'd looked it up in Wikipedia and discovered that there was a very long and detailed article, but that it didn't mention the fact that this TV show featured this character. So I added it in and was feeling very pleased with myself because, as I say, usually, like, quite a lot of the editing of Wikipedia that I do comes from my inner pedant that's, you know, quite strong and quite healthy, despite being squished into a drawer quite a lot of the time. So I always think, like, rather than sitting back going, well, that's not how you spell that word, why not just fix it? You know, that seems to be pretty reasonable. And I think a lot of the time, I remember spending quite a long time editing an article that was about a big cat that's kept in captivity, I think somewhere in Russia, and it has an Instagram. Okay. And it seemed fairly obvious to me that the person who had written the article had either direct translated it using a translator or that English was not their native language, which is totally great. Again, you know, I respect the intellectual effort and time and energy that goes into somebody creating that sort of content, but there were a few things that needed cleaned up. So yeah, I will do that if need be, but you're right, it takes time. Like when I was a baby student teacher, I was asked to create a unit of work on something, anything I liked. And I decided that I would create a unit of work on creating a Wikipedia article from scratch with the intention that I might do this one day with a class. And when I started researching what actually has to be done in order to meet the standards for Wikipedia, I realised that I would never, ever do this with a class because the standards were far too stringent and it would be a nightmare to actually get it written and cited and done properly to then actually have it be on the site and stay on the site. It's a good site, but the Scots version of it, man, it's,
It's the other thing is just the wasted, like, I mean, now I'm not even sure that my mom is listening to this particular episode, but.
Oh, it's always a risk though, like, isn't
she
it?
She has.
Hey, Judy.
Yeah, exactly. Just from me starting to say, to lament someone else's wasted potential, my mom has doubled over somewhere. And doesn't know why.
Wait a minute. Sorry. Are you talking about this in reference to your good self?
I am, yeah.
Did you not just spend the last 3 years of your life commuting from the moon to law school in order to become a lawyer? That's generally considered a job that requires potential to start off with.
Well, yes. Thank you for coming to my defense from me. But
have you not now almost pretty much, you know, become a lawyer? You're still an articling student. Is that what you say?
Articling student, yeah.
But, you know, unless your brain explodes between now and bar examinee madness, you know, you're going to be a lawyer pretty soon.
Yeah. You met me. We met, though, post university. Like, you didn't know high school me? High school me, if you'll recall, got scurvy.
High school, so, you did get scurvy, that's right.
So, yeah. But just this dude doing an entire Scots Wikipedia.
Sorry, anthology. I have to just just like Lexitecture out there. I know that Ryan edits the episodes and that maybe this will never make it into the actual episode, but can we all just reflect for a minute that while living in a first world country in the 90s, Ryan got scurvy. Yeah. Not while living on a pirate commune somewhere.
No.
Not while living on the high seas or being isolated from civilization. No, no. Ryan got scurvy in the land of supermarkets.
It was the shortest prescription any doctor has ever written me. It's like, what do I do? And the doctor
looks
like,
oranges!
Just eat a fucking orange once in a while. Like,
I should also point out that see, that it's a funny story that you got scurvy. The fact that Ryan is not the only Canadian of our age group who got scurvy in around around about the same time. The fact that I know two Canadians who've had scurvy makes me laugh almost more than I can possibly communicate to anybody. Shout out to you, Mr. Conway.
We really should have got jackets made when we discovered that. We were in Korea.
Twins.
It was super cheap to get jackets made there. We totally should have done it. Anyway, all I was going to say was just, can you imagine if this guy, this dude that wrote an entire Scots Wikipedia, can you imagine if he applied those, that tenacity and enthusiasm to something
literally
remotely
anything
worthwhile?
Else.
Like, not even overly beneficial to society, just not negative, not like entirely
trampling
irrelevant.
On a language.
It would have been amazing.
It should be pointed out also that the Reddit post where I found this, where, you know, that this whole situation was revealed to me. I'll be perfectly honest, prior to looking at this Reddit post, I didn't know that Scots Wikipedia existed. So I'm not somebody who's really banging the drum for the Scots language in a big way, because if I was, I would be aware of the fact that there was a Scots version of Wikipedia. But the post says, I've discovered that almost every single article in the Scots version of Wikipedia is written by the same person, an American teenager who can't speak Scots. And then underneath it says, edit, I've been told that the editor I've written about has received some harassment for what they've done. This should go without saying, but I don't condone this at all. And it's, I don't know, you know, it's always easier to criticise than it is to be constructive. But
right. And more fun.
I feel like it's really not funny that Scots Wikipedia has been made up by someone who doesn't know anything about Scots. But at the same time, I'm not going to like find out who that person is and trash their name. I'm not going to email them or tweet them and say, fuck you, dude, what are you doing in my life? Like, come on, man, get some perspective in your life. Who are the people out there who are defending the Scots language by like trolling some... clearly misguided, but ultimately I would assume well-meaning fan of the language.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. The internet's terrifying sometimes.
It really is. So that was the longest ever intro we've ever done before, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is the case that we should talk more often when we're not recording episodes.
Yeah. People have heard from me a bunch, so why don't you take it away this time?
Cool. On to the words. Words, words, words. So, I had a conversation this week with one of my colleagues in school. And we were talking about feeling... We were just having a generic teacher, this shit is exhausting kind of chat. And my colleague said, I feel like I have about 20 tabs open in my brain. And I said to her, have you ever actually stopped and counted how many tabs you have open on your phone? And she was like, oh yeah, sometimes I have loads. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes I actually count. So I have two counts that I make. So I use an iPhone and things stay open unless you tell them not to be open, basically. And you can double click your home button and see all of the things that are open since the last time you bothered to close them. So my current record on that is 35, right?
Wow.
35 apps open in some way, shape or form, that most of which I haven't really been aware that are still open. And The other thing is I like to keep account every now and again of the tabs that I have open in Safari on my phone. Because as a curious knowledge seeker, somebody who really loves to learn and gets annoyed when I can't find things out, smartphones really are the best thing I could possibly imagine. Oh, I wonder why this is the case. Yeah. Literally 3 seconds later, I can find out why that is the case. And that's really, really exciting to me. Like I still get excited by smartphones. I think that they're amazing. I think that it's absolutely incredible, the capabilities that we have in our pockets pretty much as standard, you know, in the sort of time and space that I'm occupying. So when I do think about a thing, like if I wonder about the names of the bones in the foot, or if I wonder about what the weather's going to be like someplace I might want to go, then quite often, if those searches throw up interesting answers, I don't necessarily have the time to engage with those interesting answers at that point, so I leave the tab open. You know, that seems pretty straightforward and simple to me.
Yeah.
However, I realised this week that I have nearly 60 tabs open on Safari.
Whoa.
At this point in time. And that seemed excessive, even for me.
That seems slightly less reasonable.
So the first one, the one right at the top, is motions and muscles of the foot. That's one that's been there for a little while, because the feet are incredibly interesting to me in one of my capacities. I've also got, there are some etymology things open. So I've still got a couple of tabs open from the question about maize versus corn.
Yep.
I have a tab about heel. It's called Heels by Number. It's about when you're knitting a sock, different ways to turn a heel. I've got...
Jeez, okay.
I've got a couple of books that people have recommended to me that I haven't gotten around to reading. An article by James Baldwin that someone sent to me that I really want to read, but I just haven't gotten to yet. Lots of stuff about movement and anatomy. Some stuff about grammar, the complex sentence. Some online shopping, bits and pieces. Supermarket shop. A whole load of research for the yoga teacher training job that I have. And now Scottish Robot. And coronavirus guidelines for various things. A page about sewing and a Google search for something that I quite frankly have forgotten why I even wanted to know what that thing was about. So this is just a little sample of the nearly 60 tabs that I currently have open on my phone. This is a bit crazy. And the long and the short of all this is I started to wonder where the word tab came from. It's just a little tiny word, and yet there's actually quite a few places that we use it. So I had a look at the OED to see, because one of the things I love so much about the OED, and it sounds like an odd thing to appreciate about a dictionary because it's literally the reason that a dictionary exists, but there are so many meanings for this word. So the OED lists six different noun meanings. So there are six entries for tab.
Jeez.
9, 1 to 6. And most of them are fairly substantial entries. So the first one, noun 1, tab, T-A-B. And the first sense of the word says a short strap or tongue and related uses. Which then goes to a short broad strap, flat loop or the like, attached by one end to an object or forming a short projecting part by which a thing can be taken hold of, hung up, fastened or pulled in various applications. See quotations. This dates first from 1607, and we have how the horse is girt, and by some special marks or observations about the tabs to know how his garth is to hold. A thing to hold on to fasten or grab another thing, basically. And so the meanings go on from there. We have leather tabs. We have tabs for bells and bell strings. We have the tab at the end of a belt. Tabs to pull up a lid. All that kind of thing. We then get a shoe latchet for fastening with a buckle button or thong, which I found quite interesting. There's lots of really interesting words to do with shoes and shoemaking. And then we get a short strap attached at one end to the side of a coat or jacket or vest, having a buttonhole at the free end for fastening across. The metal end of a lace or a shoestring. The tongue of a shoe or a boot. The pull tab used to open a can of beer. Mm-hmm. And then we get to, as an ornament of dress, each of the projecting square pieces formed by the cutting out the lower edge of a jacket or other article of dress, or sewn onto its uncut edge and usually embellished with buttons, embroidery, etc. So we get this sense of functional tab, and mm-hmm. then into kind of decorative tab. And this continues. Okay. In 19th century use, sewn on and variously adorned with buttons, beads, embroidery, etc. And then we get coloured tabs, as in army usage. So a patch or a tab worn by a senior member of staff. And then a small piece of something, the word comes to be used for this. So in 1729, we have take 3 or 4 tabs of the whitest goose dung, put all in a quart of strong beer. I don't know what this recipe was for. It doesn't sound great. I'm not going to be honest. Strong beer, you know, I'm fond of strong beer, but I've never ever felt the urge to add goose dung to my strong beer.
No,
not
it's
so
sort
far.
Of good as it is. Yeah. That's, yeah.
So the names continue, the meanings continue. We have technical and mechanical uses. So one of the revolving arms which lifts the beaters of a fulling mill, and a narrow projecting strip of metal along the inside of a hollow calico printing roller to secure it to its mandrels by means of a slot in the latter. And then in aeronautics, a usually hinged part of a control surface that serves to modify the action or response of the surface. We have luggage labels. We have an ear. Interesting, this one.
Tab. An ear?
A piece of leather in the front of a boot, a latchet, the ear. Because if you think about it, ears are, to the human head, small, sticky-out protrusions.
Little
tabs that you can take hold of. So, quite interesting. Not until 1889 do we have this sense, but I quite like that. I'm looking at the wrong plate. 1866, we have the tab, the ear. And then we have the usage meaning a cigarette. This is one that I recall I suppose those days, those teenage days where cigarettes were things that people actually cared about, because, you know, it was cool to smoke and all that stuff. I was never cool, so I didn't ever, like, you know, hide cigarettes in my school bag. But have you got any tabs? That was, that's a thing that I recall.
That's interesting. I've never heard that term for a cigarette before.
We then have to... keeping tabs on someone. This could be an abbreviation of tablet, which I find very interesting, because mm-hmm. tablet sounds like it's an abbreviation, like piglet. But it could also just be short for table or an account, to keep tabs on somebody. Then also a bill, like picking up the tab or paying the tab. And that gives us next throwing up a tab, like running up an account or using credit.
Yeah.
I
would have thought of my first thought with the keeping tabs on someone was maybe going with the idea of a projected thing that lets you hold on to something. Like if you're holding on to something, like a tab makes it easier to grab and find something. So like keeping tabs on someone, I would have. My brain immediately went to, I wonder if it's
hanging
on
to them.
You're hanging on to them somehow.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting.
But that's interesting.
I like that. The entry for cigarette says Northern dialect and slang, and the earliest citation for this is from 1934. And interestingly, the citation says, "Have you got a tab on you? The only tabs I knew were connected with the theatre, but I discovered later that tab is a common name in the North for a cigarette." I like that the citation is about someone saying, it means what now?
It's helpful when that happens.
We then go on to a tablet or a pill, specifically LSD, as in a tab of acid.
Yeah.
And we're still only on the first entry for Tab. There are five more. So we have, very, very quickly, we've got noun two, an elderly woman, or in Australian English, a young woman or girl.
Oh, the Aussies.
We've then got noun three, university slang, a member of the University of Cambridge. Tab four, theatrical slang, which is referenced in that citation I was just talking about, shortened for tableau curtain. Away from the tabs, okay. He's the same as ever. In other words, you know, without the background. So the tab curtains fell together as the girl and the man stood at arm's length from one another. Tab five, typewriting and computing. A tabulator key or a tabular stop used to preset the movement of the carriage cursor, etc., under the direction of the tabulator. In other words, the key that you find on your keyboard that jumps the cursor along a little bit. And noun six, shortened from tabloid, it's believed, a short play or sketch, typically a condensed version of a longer work. And this is referred to in US theatre. It's given as historical, although the first citation for it is only from 1915. So a burlesque tab or a musical comedy tab. And then also our US English meaning tab, shortened for tabloid.
Right.
So there's a lot of ground to be covered for this very small, seemingly insignificant thing. The OED doesn't have anything to say directly about tabs on a phone, tabs on a computer. Although it does, of course, mimic the physical tabs that you would find in a filing cabinet. You know, that's how, you know, I'm using Safari and Chrome organises its tabs in the same way. It's as though you're looking at a drawer of a filing cabinet and here are all the little pieces. So I was interested to see that there isn't a specific entry within its definitions to talk about its use in computing other than the tab key.
That seems like it is probably something they're going
to
throw in there sometime soon.
Get
like
to.
That's because this has been around for, I mean, not a long time by OED standards, but I don't know, browser tabs have been a thing for a while now.
Yeah, but like as I say, you know, I thought the same thing. It's like, oh, no browser tabs. And then I realised that browser tabs aren't, they're not a new thing. They're a graphical representation of a very old thing. So does that deserve a new entry in the OED? Or I certainly agree that it's interesting to compare the two.
I mean, icon, you could say the same thing about a word like icon.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there are lots of usages within modern computing and you know, media use that come from much, much older words. I don't know if they all have separate definitions or not.
Yeah, I say that without having looked up icon to make sure that it's actually in there in the computer form.
So, etymologically, we have the wonderful, wonderful phrase, origin obscure.
Nice.
I'm not surprised that this word is of obscure origin for several reasons. Firstly, because the word itself is a small, insignificant thing, a part of a thing that you may not even have considered as a separate part.
Right, yeah.
So I feel like, you know, the word tab is not a word that's been noticed a great deal. Yeah. This is my hunch, entirely unscientific. So what the OED has to say is origin obscure, at first a dialect word. It's not in Johnson's dictionary. And in some senses, it may be short for tablet. In others, it interchanges with tag. Etymonline has similar stuff to say about it. A small flap or strip of material is how they cite it, from around about 1600. Possibly from a dialectical word of uncertain origin. Often interchangeable with tag, T-A-G. Mm-hmm. Which hadn't really occurred to me, which is madness, because they're literally one letter different. But a tab and a tag in my head are not the same, so I've never really kind of conflated them. So tag is a bit earlier. It dates from around about 1400, according to Etymonline, and they reckon it comes probably from a Scandinavian source. So we have Norwegian tag with two G's, meaning point or prong or barb, and the Swedish tag, again T-A-G-G, meaning prickle or thorn, relating to Middle Low German tag with an E on the end, meaning branch, twig or spike.
Hmm.
The sense development might be point of metal at the end of a cord or string, etc., hence the part hanging loose. Or, I like this one, I don't know how much credence it would have with proper etymologists. Etymonline says, or perhaps ultimately from pi, deck, D-E-K. So you see a lot of translation from D's into T's. You can... Mm. If you say enough words starting with either T or D, you can see how that sim change has come about. So the pi root deck, meaning a root forming words referring to fringe, horsetail, locks of hair.
Hmm.
So the sense of a hanging down thing, a thing that can be taken hold of, that makes good etymological sense to me. There's another interesting point in the entry for tag on Etym Online. The second sense here given is... the children's game, dating from around about 1738, and perhaps a variation of Scott's tig. Now, I would never ever call that game where you run after someone and try to touch them tag. It's completely foreign to me. In Scotland, we say tig.
Oh, okay.
Very much so. And tig means to touch or to tap.
Oh, okay.
Probably an alteration of Middle English, tech, T-E-K, touch or tap, like tick. The baseball sense is from 1912. And then this entire sentence is a big, bold link. It's not an acronym and doesn't stand for anything.
Nice.
So, of course, who's not going to click on a link like that?
Absolutely.
And this led me to a little article on Etym Online that I really enjoyed. The title of the article is Acronymphomania.
Oh, I like that.
And it refers to the notion of the first sentence says the latest appalling idiocy of the internet is that the name of the children's game tag is an acronym. Now, earlier you said, I mean, hate is a strong word, but my God, the frustration is palpable. The Twitter bilge goes, how old were you when you learned that the game tag stands for touch and go?
Backronyms are just so interesting to me because I don't understand why people want to make things needlessly complicated.
So this very scathing and hilarious article, I really, really enjoyed it. And it goes through some of the reasons for the nonsensical nature of backronyms. So one of the examples that's given, it gives you a little checklist to say, how do you know if it's a backronym or if it's a real acronym? And so it's interesting. It's you know, it's good common sense. So they have 5 points. Number one, look at the earliest form of the word. The meme that says shit is an acronym, founders on the old English form of the world, which began with an SC. That doesn't fit the story.
Right.
So it says to look for the earliest form of the world. Why do you keep saying world for word? It says to look for relatives and cognates, which is, of course, very sensible. To look at context. The example given there is that golf.
Oh, yeah.
There's a story saying gentlemen only, ladies forbidden. It says it's based on a 20th century social sensibility that would have been irrelevant to word formation in 15th century Scotland, where golf originates, as gouf, G-O-U-F, rather than golf. So... the Scots word was anglicised into golf. The acronym doesn't make any sort of sense. And then look at dates, abbreviations that become words or new things. And this was interesting. The article says most of them are kind of post 1941, and most of the rest are post 1914.
Mm.
And the wars are given, the respective wars are given as... good sort of indications that these are times when acronyms proliferate. And then the last one is Occam's razor applies. Yeah. The generators of fake etymologies often pick a word marked of uncertain origin in the dictionaries, but their acronym theory still has to pass the 4 questions above. Now, it's just occurred to me, I wanted to talk about this. I've actually been wanting to talk about this for a long time because it's kind of new knowledge to me, but Occam's razor you know this principle, you know this, this phrase. Occam's razor basically says, look for the simplest possible explanation. I discovered that there is also a Hanlon's razor.
Hmm.
Now, this is, of course, it's of interest to me because my name is Hanlon. Hanlon is my married name, so I am really super excited to have married into a razor family. And Hanlon's razor is pretty wonderful. You've probably seen this principle before. It's used frequently on the internet. And Hanlon's razor states, never attribute to malice that which can accurately be attributed to stupidity.
Yes. I like that.
So, yeah, tag, tab, of uncertain origin, however, pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it's perhaps one of these words that is used for all those words, all those things that we don't really have a name for. And whether that's happened by malice or by stupidity, I have no idea.
Hard to say. That's very cool. Yeah, those backrooms. Send me the link to that because I'm going to put that in the show notes so people can see that article because it's, I feel like it's important. But it's the connection with tag is interesting. I especially like the fact that I think it was Swedish. It's like a specifically irritating little tickle or prickling thing. And it just makes me think of like,
just like
the tags on the back
you have
of
a
your
new
shirt.
T-shirt. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's like, that's, man, the Swedes, they were right on with their furniture and meatballs and accurate depictions of what tags do to you. Good stuff.
Yeah, I never thought of that. Sometimes it genuinely does feel as though you're being attacked by your own clothing.
Yeah, it's terrible. Very cool. I am going to talk about the word fear.
Ooh.
And it's sort of a short one, but I did find some kind of interesting things about this. It reminded me a little bit of when we talked about nightmare, which is
okay.
One of my favorite words to dive into, just because it sort of,
yeah,
the history of nightmare, like the history of the word fear, it sort of flipped on its head what it was talking about. So I'll just jump right in. So fear dates back to Old English, which makes sense because you would sort of assume that a word for a very basic emotion would be very old. You know, people have been experiencing something akin to what we call fear now for quite some time, I would imagine.
Yeah,
and so of course there's a word for it. And of course it's very old. So it's Old English. The first citation is Beowulf. And it's, now I actually looked up a little like YouTube video on pronunciation of Old English.
Oh, this is
so
foxy.
Hi, say fair begeit, is I think how it's.
Fair begeit.
But it's like it's that AE, and apparently that's supposed to be like the A in cat, so fair.
Fair begeit.
Yeah, say fair begeit, I guess, but I don't know. Kevin Stroud's rolling his eyes, if he's even listening. Hello, Kevin.
I love mangling Old English. I love it so much.
However, what's interesting is what it originally meant in Old English was a sudden and terrible event or peril.
Ooh.
And it wasn't until sort of the end of the 12th century, so you get to like 1190 something or other, and that's when it starts to take on the sense that the OED describes as the emotion of pain or uneasiness caused by the sense of impending danger or by the prospect of some possible evil.
Oh, this is lovely. Keep going.
You know, it's the thing, and then it's the emotion worrying about the thing. But originally it was the thing. And then, of course, it's stayed more or less the same since the end of the 12th century, like just that sense of foreboding and the rest of the stuff. It's a Germanic, Scandinavian, Norse origin word. And it's interesting to look at what the ancestors of the word fear meant in the various Scandinavian languages, like the various cognates, because they're all obviously related and you can definitely tell, you can see how they're related, but they're all just slightly different. And I find it fascinating to think about what, if anything, that might say about the worlds that created these words. So
yeah.
The old Saxon
antecedent to fear meant ambush. The old High German meant stratagem or danger, as well as ambush. The old Norse meant misfortune or plague. And Gothic doesn't have a specific sort of version, but the derivative word that the OED lists meant liar in wait. And so it's that's the fear. The fear is the thing that's either coming to get you or I think worse, waiting for you. Because there's that sense of ambush.
They're somewhere. Who knows when, who knows where, but waiting.
And it's interesting that Old Norse had that plague. Plague was the fear in Old Norse. And so, and this, the goose dung in beer really cemented it for me. The past was a terrible place. Like, what an appalling thing that we have all been through as a species to get here. Like, this is bad, this current moment. Like, people bitch and whine about 2020, but nobody's putting goose crap in your beer now. Least of all you. You know, like, imagine being in a place where you thought that was a good idea. So
I remember that the first time it occurred to me that the past was a terrible, terrible place was when I was maybe about 13, 14, and doing an investigation at school into Roman medicine.
Oh, just...
And discovering... Well, I've talked about that in the past, trepanning.
Yeah.
Like, the Romans drilled holes in people's skulls.
Yeah.
Anesthesia didn't exist until all the Romans were fossils.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, and they did that to help.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's just, exactly.
And the other thing is, I'm saying this, like, the past is an awful place. I'm saying this as, like, a middle to upper middle class, white, straight dude. So...
Yeah.
I was going to get the best the past had to offer me. Now, I had terrible eyesight as a kid, so I would...
You would get the quality goose dung, dude.
Nothing but the best, finest white goose dung. But... Now, I had glasses as a kid, so anytime before the 20th century, I would have just been a blind beggar from birth because they would have thrown me out because I couldn't see. But...
That's okay. I'm a woman.
Well, that's just
so
what I'm saying.
Like, I would be fucked.
If it was, it would have been terrible for me. But man, what an awful place the past was. Anyway, so that's, and I had been reading about this whole fear thing. How it was like all this stuff that was happening to you was the actual fear, and then the goose dung and beer thing really pushed me over the edge. anyway.
Do what you like to Ryan, but don't mess with his beer.
Oh, especially strong beer. You got a good strong beer, you're gonna put anyway. Ugh. So by and large, that's kind of the story of fear. So because it sort of hasn't done a whole lot over the last, you know, 800 or 900 years in terms of sense change. So you do get certain applications
fear is
of
fear.
It. So you get like the fear of God, putting the fear of God into someone. And that's you get a kind of a tinge of not like pure dread or actual fear, but there's like some reverence in there a little bit. There's like, so anyway, it's a really minor change, but it, you know, what I found interesting about that phrase specifically, the put the fear of God into someone, is that the earliest citation of that in the OED is actually to rub the fear of God into someone.
No.
And that just does not sound as scary to me. Like, it sounds creepier, but not as actually scary, you know?
I'm a massage therapist, and I know a fellow massage therapist who'll talk about, oh, I'm needing a good rub.
Yeah.
And, like, essentially, that is what a massage therapist does to you. Like, a big part of the treatment will involve some form of rubbing. Yeah. But we don't call it that. No. And I think there's a good reason why we don't call it that, because you're correct. It just sounds a bit creepy.
Yeah. So you can rub the fear of God.
Rub the fear of God.
Or you used to be able to.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's weird.
See, I'm now imagining, where does one rub? In order to...
Yeah, what's the best place to rub the fear of God into someone?
To transfer the place of God, which part should be
rubbed? I have ideas, but I'm not saying any of them.
How? How should the rubbing take place? Is it like a brisk?
Is it vigorous?
I have so many questions.
Is it gradual? I don't know. Yeah, it's exactly. There's so many different questions about this. It's also interesting that it, when I noticed and looked into the whole fear used to mean the fear thing that you were afraid of, it immediately called to mind that Roosevelt line, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And it turns it a little more pragmatic than philosophical when it's like, if you knew about that stuff. Now, the people will note that I haven't actually talked about the etymology yet, and I guess that's sort of what we do. So, but it's because there's a bit of a disagreement as far as where this comes from. So both Edom Online...
Oh, fight, 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 fight. Brilliant.
Edom Online...
Nothing I like better than the thought of etymologists shaking down.
Absolutely, just in a parking lot somewhere. Dictionaries and thesauruses just like...
Street countdown.
Glinting in the streetlights.
Yeah.
Edom Online and the American Heritage Dictionary both sort of trace it to a pie root. Per, P-E-R, meaning to try or to risk. Now, we came across this with pirate.
Yes.
Because pirate is one of the cognates from this pie root. Episode 20, for those keeping track. Other cognates with this root include peril, empirical, as in based on experimentation, and also experiment, experience, and expert all come from this to try or to risk pie root. However, the OED throws a little wrinkle into that. It the little line at the end of its etymology section says that the base, quote, is probably one of the Alblaut forms of the Aryan root pair to go through. But the genesis of the sense is not clear. The current comparison with, and it gives a couple Greek Latin words meaning trial, attempt, risk, seems to be misleading. Now, it doesn't go beyond that as far as why it seems to be misleading or what's misleading about it. And the other two, and of course, like, the Aryan root pair has to go through, and so there's, it's the same spelling of the root, but just a slightly different sense. And it's definitely the more prevalent sense of that root or different root. Because it's got a lot more cognates with that than the try or risk.
So, to go through as to endure?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that would be the... But that's,
like, to experience?
I guess that's why it says sort of the sense genesis isn't super clear. So I guess the idea is that there are problems with it that are more technical, having to do with the actual sort of mechanics of language chains and morphological shifts and all that other stuff that is...
All that really cool, scary stuff that we... It's beyond
the
us.
The realm of real etymologists. But where it falls down is the fact that it's kind of hard to go, okay, well, how do you make that square with the sense of it all? And then vice versa, I think that's probably where, when it says it seems misleading, is that there's probably something about the usage or the morphology, etc., that makes it difficult for the trial and risk one. But anyway, so that's fear.
Awesome. I love the notion of the only thing to fear is fear itself, making good etymological sense.
Yeah, I like that as well. He was accidentally accurate.
Yeah, he was. I had a conversation this week with one of my pupils who I already like a lot purely because we had this conversation, where he said, but that's just the same thing said two different ways. And I said, actually, not quite. And so we did a bit of nitpicking as to why the two things that had been said were similar, but that they had a different nuance.
Yeah.
And after which he said, English is so stupid. And I laughed and agreed with him.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. to get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.